You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, continuing our month-long look at the crossover between comics and film, I'm talking to film writer stroke director and comic scripter Greg Pak about his work, from a variety of short films increasingly available online, to his feature film Robot Stories, and his tenure at Marvel Comics, which has included writing The Incredible Hulk on and off for the last 4 years, and its spin-off title Incredible Hercules, co-written with Fred Van Lent. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
The theme of this month's shows is people who have worked in both film and comics, and that's obviously something that's very applicable to you. I was just looking at your website, and you've recently uploaded short films that you did in 1997 and 2005. So I guess your two creative pursuits, both working in film and working in comics, have developed alongside each other.
Yeah, well, I started off as a filmmaker. I actually started off as a cartoonist way back when.
Okay.
When I was in, from the age of seven on, I was drawing. I cartooned for my school papers in high school and college. And so that was always something I was doing. But at a certain point, I realized that I never thought about cartooning professionally. At a certain point, and I actually studied totally different things. I studied political science and then later history at Yale, and then I went to Oxford and studied history. But while I was at Oxford, of all places, I got involved with the student filmmaking group and realized that's really what I needed to be doing. And I applied to and got into NYU and kind of haven't looked back since. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity both at Oxford and then later at NYU to actually start doing this, and I made a feature film called Robot Stories that came out in 2000. Well, we hit festivals starting in 2002 and 2003. Came out theatrically in 2004. Actually, it played Sci-Fi London in 2004, and those guys were amazing and actually gave it an award. But it was through Robot Stories then that I finally got back into comics, because my agent found out that Marvel was looking for writers and sent over the screenplay to Robot Stories, and I ended up getting hired to write comic books. So it's been this kind of funny journey going from one genre to the other, or one media to the other. And I've kept doing films throughout, but just short films. So my most recent short film, of course, is Mr. Green, that showed at Sci-Fi London.
It's interesting that you should say that your agent told you about Marvel Comics, because it seems that both Marvel and DC lately have been trying to attract new talent from outside the comics industry, people who write novels, people who write TV shows, people who write movies. And I think that comics perhaps used to be quite insular in the kind of people that they would hire. Maybe it would be mainly people who had been to illustration school or were fans of comics. And I think it's very healthy for the industry that not only are people who work in other industries now making comics, but actually the comics companies are actively looking outside their own niche.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have benefited from that. I mean, I think everybody gets into comics through a totally different route, it seems. Everybody breaks in through a different, you talk to 10 different people and they have 10 different stories, and you can't really use any of them as a blueprint, you know what I'm saying? Because it's a very subjective kind of thing where people just kind of stumble into it in different ways. But definitely there have been a lot of folks coming from film and television into comics. And then, I mean, I'm also excited about the fact that a lot of comics people are now moving into film, not just in by having their creative properties being made into films, but actually playing a role in making the films. you know, you've got Frank Miller, of course, I guess is the highest profile person doing that, but you've got folks. I think John Cassidy is about to direct, has directed some stuff and is doing more. He's best known to comics fans as the illustrator of Planetary and Astonishing X-Men, and there are a lot of other folks who are doing things like this, and I think that's a great thing. It makes a lot of sense because, you know, comics, film, television, these are all visual media and dramatic storytelling. So the basic principles of storytelling are the same for all of these different, you know, it's just that there are certain differences in how, in the specifics of how you're going to write the script, but you know, if you have understood the principles of dramatic storytelling, you can apply them over different fields. So it makes sense.
Hmm. And presumably when it comes to writing scripts for movies, it's as much as you're trying to create a scenario that can be visualized. So in a lot of ways, the two disciplines share a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I mean, there are interesting differences in that. You know, I personally think it's actually harder work writing a comic script because you tend to, I mean, comics writers usually break down the script panel by panel. Which means you're doing some of the work that, say, a director would do in a movie. And if you're writing a film script, you're not breaking it down shot by shot. You're not literally writing, you know, when each new shot happens. I mean, sometimes writers will do that, but that's generally frowned upon because that's generally thought of as something that the director and the cinematographer are going to do. But typically in comics, when folks are writing in what they call the full script mode, which is, you know, which most people do these days, I think. The writer is writing down each panel, often, you know, describing, you know, how close you are on a shot, what you're seeing in the shot. And of course, there's always, you know, a lot of leeway and flexibility and collaboration going on where an artist may say, well, you know what, this is going to work better as two panels, or maybe I can even do these three panels as a single panel, or maybe, you know, the framing you're suggesting here should be a little different. And that's great because that just means it gets better because you've got, the great visual storytellers working together to make it as good as it can be. But just the upfront work in terms of thinking the thing out visually, I think that a little bit more of that happens in comics than happens in film writing. So that's an interesting difference. There are also certain challenges to comic book writing that filmmakers don't quite have to worry about, in the sense of, like, if you're going to show continuous action, in a film, you just see it. In a comic book, you have to sometimes figure out how you're going to use multiple panels. Like, if you're going to use a very superhero-specific kind of event, if somebody's going to be teleporting, you may need, I mean, depending on how you're figuring it, you may need multiple panels to do that in a comic book. But in a film, you know, that can happen over the course of, you know, a split second, and it doesn't need more space, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
So there are, you know, there are different considerations like that. There's also different considerations like, you know, that a comic book is broken up not by time. Like, a movie is literally broken up by time, right? You're sitting watching a movie as time goes along. In a comic book, time is sort of determined by pages and page turns. So you're thinking about, in a movie, you might be thinking about, you know, what's going to happen in the first couple of minutes, in the first 5 minutes, in the first 15 minutes, in the first half hour, you know, at those different points in time, there needs to be kind of something there, little hooks at different points in time, you know, definitely at the end of that first act, you want to have that hook that keeps people watching. In a comic book, that gets broken down a little differently. It's more like in the first page, you want to hook people in it. And frankly, at the end of every single page, you want to give people a reason to turn the page. So the way suspense works, just on a, you know, moment by moment basis is a little different because you're just the experience of sitting watching a movie and the experience of paging through a comic book are different physical experiences. So it makes you think about how you're structuring things a little differently.
Well, and also when it came to writing films before your first comic, you were directing them yourself. And so I guess you're writing for yourself in a sense, and so therefore you didn't need to explain things in a way that a director who wasn't familiar with your work wouldn't have to interpret. And so therefore, when it came to writing comics, for the first time, you were having to find an artist who could interpret what you intended in a way that wasn't maybe as intuitive as it was when it was making films.
I think my film scripts are a little more evocative, or what's the best way to put it, poetic, or they're just maybe just a better read because
yeah.
there's less interruption, you know what I mean? Like, they're a little bit more like their own literary art form. I mean, I think you can read one of my film scripts and it feels like better writing just because there's less interruption. But the comic scripts tend to be a little more dense because there's just more exposition crammed in there to kind of explain what you're looking at. When I'm writing for, even when I'm writing a film script that I'm directing, I still need to include all the relevant information because there's always going to be a bunch of other folks that I'm working with who need to be able to look at that. And, you know, you've got costume designers and cinematographer and the folks who are dealing with the set design. And all of those folks need to be able to look at that script and understand what they need to do. Of course, we are talking face-to-face about it all the time. But still, the script needs to contain the key information. So I don't know that there's that much of a difference between the film scripts I've written just for myself and the film scripts I've written for hire for other people in terms of that. Like, I don't think I've bare-bones did so much with my own scripts. But you are correct. The comic scripts do tend to be a little denser. One thing, though, is that as I work with a single artist, you know, over a longer period of time, I definitely, the artist and I, you know, we develop our own, we develop a vibe, and I the scripts tend to get less wordy as we go along, just because we've sort of developed a sensibility for each other, and I don't have to over-explain as much. I think it's also, as I've worked in comics longer, I've also kind of learned how to say what I need to say without taking up quite so much space. I think I have a lot of, I'm very grateful to some of the early artists I worked with early in my career who had to deal with a lot of verbiage, probably too much commentary for me. I think I've gotten a little looser and a little less, I've gone a little bit less overboard as I've continued along. But at the same time, you definitely also don't want to leave artists hanging, you know, where you're shorthanding everything and then they don't have the information they need to really stage the scene. Because they're trying to get to what you're looking for and do something, you know, and add their own special thing. But if I'm unclear, if I'm too vague, that puts way too much work on their shoulders, and it also, you know, it just gets frustrated because then they have to spend time chasing down, you know, trying to get explanations and chase things down. So, you know, it's always a work in progress trying to get better at that for me.
With the exception of Battlestar Galactica, all of the comics that you've written have been for Marvel. And so probably, I guess, inevitably, the first comic you did for them wasn't on one of their top-tier titles. It was a reimagining of Warlock with Charlie Adlard.
Yeah.
So was that a character that you had to research before writing the first issue, or were you actually a bit of a Marvel nerd to begin with?
Oh, I definitely had read those. I'd read the Starlin Warlock stuff back in the day. I grew up reading comics. I didn't have a giant library of comics just because I wasn't, when I started, there was no comic book store near me, and I was doing that thing of, like, you know, biking to the local 7-Eleven, which I don't know what the equivalent of 7-Eleven is in England, but it's the, it's the local convenience store where they used to have comic books on the newsstand there. I'd bike down there, you know, and I never knew when the comics were coming out, so I could never necessarily get them sequentially. So I would have this, you know, kind of random grab bag of comics, but I loved them. And of course, I've got a few issues that I bought years ago, you know, back during those days, and I never got the subsequent issues, so I have no idea how those storylines ended. You know, it's like this 40-year, you know, like 30 years of tension where I'm wondering how those storylines ended. But, I mean, and that was that's a really kind of fun way to grow up reading comics, because it's just that whole experience of, you know, tracking the books down is that's kind of part of the fun of it at that age and at that time. I was definitely familiar with all of the major Marvel characters. I had those Origins and Son of Origins trade paperbacks that Marvel issued way back when, and had pored over those origin stories again and again. And there were other key comics that I had had over the years. So I was definitely very familiar with a lot of those characters. At a certain point, my neighborhood did get a comic book store, so I was reading a lot more. There were certain, you know, books that just blew my mind from a very young age. But those Warlock stories definitely were, that was stuff I was familiar with. Although I hadn't read the very first appearances of Warlock. And actually that was what the editor who hired me pointed me to when I first started working on that. He said, you know, when you look at the original stories, Warlock was, he's an artificial person. It was created by these crazy, you know, utopian fascist scientists who were using to take over the world and create a utopia. That editor had just seen Robot Stories, and so he thought that I had an interesting take on artificial intelligence.
Okay.
And thought that I might be a good person to tackle that that project.
Hmm.
So that was a blast. It was that particular project was a big challenge because it was a reimagining, but it was also set in the core Marvel universe. It's just that you weren't going to find out that that was the case until a little bit later down the line. But when the first issue came out, people were just kind of confused. I didn't really understand how it had been a while since I had regularly bought a lot of comics, and so I didn't really understand how the fan community kind of reacted to new projects. I didn't understand I was less aware than as I am now of the importance of letting folks know how things were going to fit into continuity, and the sense that things matter and that kind of a sense. So that Warlock story didn't do a very good job of explaining that particular fact from the beginning. Eventually, it all did tie back in this kind of glorious, mind-bending way. So I'm very proud of that little four-issue book. But alas, not so many people read it.
And also, it must have been an interesting experience because the artist you worked with, Charlie Adlard, is a Brit. So did you have any amusing cultural differences when you were trying to explain things to him in the script?
I don't think anything like that actually ever did come up. It's funny because that was my first experience, of course, with working with a comic book artist, and it's a very common thing that in this industry that you never, ever talk to or meet the person you're working with. You know, I mean, you're sending emails back and forth, but, you know, I think the first few artists I lived with lived in, you know, like 5 out of 6 of them were in different countries. You know what I'm saying? So I actually did meet Charlie years later, which was very nice when we finally met. But at the time we never, you know, we were trading emails and that was great. But you know, Charlie, he was great. I know the joke of, you know, of course, you know, England and the United States. What is it? A common nation separated by a language? No, I can't remember how it goes. No, what is it? Separated by a common language?
Yeah, two nations separated by a common language.
Exactly. I don't think that was really so much of an issue. Maybe, you know, I did spend a couple of years myself in England, but not that I was peppering my script with Englishisms for Charlie's benefit or anything. I think that worked out fine. Charlie is fantastic. I mean, he was, I think he had recently started writing, illustrating Walking Dead around the time that he was working on Warlock. And so he was turning out 2 books a month, which was, you know, that's virtually unheard of, that a comic book artist can do that, but he just did an amazing job on the book, and he was a lot of fun to be the first artist I was working with out of the game.
Between Warlock and your start on Hulk, you worked on various kind of non-Marvel Universe titles, such as the Nemesis miniseries, a House of M miniseries, a 1602 miniseries. Did it help in a way that those titles weren't as obsessed with continuity before you delved into a book that was one of the main kind of Marvel mainstays?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I had actually never really thought of it that way, but you're right. I did. I worked on that House of M thing, which was, yes, it was part of the main, you know, main continuity, but it was the whole conceit was that it was an alternate vision of the world. 1602, of course, is a separate world, and then the Marvel Nemesis. set in Marvel continuity. They're actually, you know, interacting with the new Avengers and everything. But it was kind of its own thing because it was a setup for a video game. I mean, I think all of those books were incredibly helpful for me to work on because they let me work with a ton of different Marvel characters in a very short amount of time. And that's excellent. That's great. That's a great opportunity, great practice, because it lets you, you know, get used to working in all these different voices and kind of get up to speed and really get to know all of these different characters. And it also let me play with the characters in different kinds of ways. Like the 1602 book that I did, 1602 New World, I guess my favorite part of that book was playing with Banner and the Hulk. And Neil Gaiman had done an amazing thing with 1602 where he kind of envisioned a different kind of Banner, which, you know, had Banner as a villain, basically. So that kind of set up something pretty awesome for the New World story, where if Banner is kind of a villain, and the Hulk, then the Hulk could be a different kind of Hulk. I mean, and the premise eventually became this notion that the Hulk was a hero. You know, that the Hulk was the hero that Banner was trying to suppress, or that was denying, you know, or had forgotten himself. And in a lot of ways, that became something that I would later on explore in Planet Hulk, and maybe, you know, maybe you see shades of that now in the Fall of the Hulks and World War Hulk storyline, where we're dealing with a very different kind of Banner. So, you know, working on those kinds of alternate reality stories can be a great way of kind of wrapping your head around characters in different ways. I mean, these characters are kind of amazing. I think they have the lasting power they have because they are. Because they have such strong basic premises, and at the same time they're incredibly flexible, that you can tell a lot of different sort of stories with them. So it's been fun to have the opportunity to play with them a bit, and then to really run with you know, slightly different takes of these characters.
One character that you introduced to the Marvel Universe was Amadeus Cho in Amazing Fantasy, who then went on to become a sidekick of Hercules. When you first created the character, were you hoping that he would then have a greater life in the Marvel Universe beyond that one issue?
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of funny, because when I first started, you know, this is actually the first time I'm telling you this, or telling anybody this, but when I first started working on the idea for that character, I kind of thought, maybe I should, you know, try to do this as a creator-owned character. You know, because it was an original idea, and I just thought it was... I felt there was kind of something special about it, but I knuckled down. I was like, you know what? No, this is going to be a Marvel character because I want to see this character in the Marvel universe. This character just really, you know, it will be a fun character to set loose in the Marvel universe, and I think might really have a shot at being a kind of a lasting character in the Marvel U. I think that's also kind of one of the fantasies of a lot of us, you know, newer writers, so to speak. That. You know, we love the characters we get to play with so much, and it's kind of a fantasy that we might create something that, you know, years from now somebody else will love to play with, you know. And so that was, you know, I definitely have hope that, you know, after I've, you know, had my time, that folks will come in and keep playing with Amadeus Cho. And that, I mean, I'd love it if, you know, I already love it when folks like Dan Slott, you know, and Paul Tobin and other folks have used Amadeus. It's just very exciting. You know, I hope that will continue. That character is definitely very near and dear to my heart, though. I think there's a lot of, he's been a lot of fun to develop. And Fred Van Lente has been amazing. He's my co-writer on Incredible Hercules. And the two of us have just kind of, you know, really fallen in love with the character and found, you know, figured out what his big story arc is in conjunction with Hercules. Been working on this massive run, which is nearing its climax now, actually. The Amadeus is actually going to star in a miniseries called Heroic Age, Prince of Power, that starts in May, and that'll run for 4 issues. And then the big final climactic conclusion to our first giant Hercules story will kick in after that. I can't reveal exactly what that is or what format is now, but it's coming. And so it's been really an amazing opportunity to have that venue to really build that character up, and particularly in conjunction with Hercules, has been just a hugely fun character to write as well.
But then that means your final story with Amadeus Cho will be at some point within the next year.
Well, I won't. I'll never say final. Well,
okay.
But I will say it's the last big story in this first giant Hercules storyline that we've been working on. How's that for overly convoluted? But yeah, I mean, since we started this the Hercules book, it came out of World War Hulk, and it just became its own thing. And I think it's something like 40 or 50 issues now altogether of story over the course of three and a half years. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, we still marvel over the fact that it's gone on this long and that so many people have been so supportive of it. But yeah, this the giant storyline that we conceived fairly early on will have its big climax. Within the next year.
Okay.
And then to be announced / determined what will happen next. But Amadeus also is playing a supporting role in the Incredible Hulk book right now. So you can also get your fill of him there. By the way, Amadeus also has a Twitter account.
So yes,
Twitter,
I know.
Check out Amadeus Cho. If you talk to him on Twitter, he just might talk back.
I'll spread the word.
So he likes you.
But what I was getting at was, I think one thing that's probably very, invigorating as a comic book writer is that if you do have a popular following, then you can give a story a beginning, a middle, and an end. You don't have to worry so much as, say, if you were making television, about the vagaries of the market and whether it's going to get cancelled or wrapped up before its time. And so with a character like Amadeus, you've had 4 or 5 years to tell all the stories that you passionately wanted to tell about that character. And presumably you've had a similar affection for the Hulk as well, because you've written about 35, 36 issues of the Hulk so far as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel very lucky on both those counts. I mean, comics actually, I think they actually are fairly similar to television, where stuff does get canceled all the time. And folks do have to wrap it up. But there is, I mean, one of the nice things about comics, though, is that it's a business, right? So it has to make money. But at the same time, people are willing to try crazier things in comics than they're willing to try, say, in the movies or in a lot of other media, because the upfront costs are so much less. It's not cheap, but it's vastly cheaper than doing, making Avatar or making a feature film. Fewer people have to sign off on it, so you end up with the opportunity to have just quirkier, crazier stories and characters that then actually have the potential to really blow up and become something huge. Sometimes, it's that kind of risk-taking is the only thing that's going to allow that really great thing to come out to really find its audience. So, yeah, I mean, so I've loved working in comics before. That's one of the reasons I love working in comics, because stuff just can get approved and get out there in the world. And at the same time, I've been very lucky, as you say, with Amadeus and with the Hulk stuff. I've been able to tell these giant stories, but that's not always the case. So I count my blessings, and I thank you for plugging this stuff, and I thank all the fans for buying the books, because that's really what makes it possible.
As well as being able to tell these long story arcs that help develop a character three-dimensionally over time, another theme in your work that's obviously very important to you is portrayals of strong Asian American characters, both in your films such as Robot Stories and in the character of Amadeus.
Yeah, I definitely have had a lot of Asian American characters, of course, in my films and in my comics. I think I've had an instinct towards diversity in general, not just Asian Americans, but just getting different faces up there. In general. It's kind of funny. I look back over some of the stuff I've done recently. I mean, I did this Magneto Testament book, which is the origin story of Magneto as a Jewish kid, struggling to survive in the face of the Final Solution and the rise of the Nazis. And then I did the War Machine book, which, of course, stars Jim Rhodes, one of Marvel's preeminent heroes, also one of Marvel's preeminent African-American heroes. And then, of course, the Amadeus Cho stuff. I there's in a lot of ways, I guess I've, you know, maybe, you know, in a way, maybe it's also one of the reasons why I like working at Marvel. Because I think Marvel has always been, Marvel kind of made its mark back in the day as the place where the heroes were underdogs. And that was a big part of the appeal, you know, that the heroes were misunderstood, generally misunderstood outcasts, you know. And I think that's a very democratic and very accepting and very human and humane kind of way to tell a story. Because I think everybody feels like that at some point. So that kind of it always seemed like a place where these kinds of stories, you know, could be told and could make sense, and where a variety of different kinds of characters could all be taken seriously and find an audience. So I've been, I feel like Marvel's been a very great place for me to be working. I also love the fact that, nobody, when I threw out the idea for Amadeus, for Amadeus from the beginning, was like, yeah, that's awesome. Nobody, his race never ever came up. People were just like, yeah, that's awesome, let's do it. And we did it. And the fact that Magneto and the War Machine books were, that those were, things that editors were championing. It's a great place to try to build those kinds of stories. So I've been grateful. This is a good place to plug an anthology I was part of called Secret Identities. It's a non-Marvel thing. It's an independent thing, but it's a bunch of superhero stories told by different Asian American writers and artists. I did a piece in there called The Citizen, in which the President of the United States, newly inaugurated President of the United States, who looks remarkably like Barack Obama, thaws out a super soldier who had been put on ice years before for trying to arrest the previous president for illegally starting a war. I have no idea where I got that idea. So that's one of the stories that I did in that Secret Identity. That's the story I did for that Secret Identities book. But if you're interested in this kind of stuff, that's also a pretty fun book to grab.
I'll definitely check it out. Having worked in both film and comics, possibly a development that combined the two that maybe you weren't expecting was the adaptation of Planet Hulk into an animated film.
Yeah, that blew my mind. I was thrilled by that. I mean, they brought me on board as a consultant, so I got to see the script in an early stage and throw in my two cents and all that. And I was just amazed by how loyal they tried to stay to the original storyline and how many of those, elements from the comic, became, directly translated into scenes in the movie. And it's just a lot of fun. I mean, I think there's a lot of room for more of that kind of stuff, and I hope to get involved on even more involved with that over time. So we'll see.
But
that's a huge thrill. I mean, I've had a few, there are, other kinds of crazy moments like that. Like the first time I found out that they were going to make an action figure out of one of the characters that I created. They made a Scar action figure, Scar Son of Hulk, and I was trading notes with the folks who were designing the character, designing the box, But it's kind of crazy to have stuff that, I'm going to make it up one day, turn into some other crazy product another day.
And do you have any idea yet how well the Planet Hulk cartoon has done? Because obviously, even to the casual observer, the Hulk is left on an alien planet. And so the status quo at some point needs to be returned, and the Hulk himself to Earth.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I haven't heard yet what's coming next. But my fingers are crossed. That's all I can say.
And to make a very awkward segue, the other short film you've worked on recently is Mr. Green, which ironically isn't about the Hulk.
Yes, how about that? it was a short film. I got the chance to submit an application to ITVS, which is the independent television service. It's an organization that usually funds public television shows. They're best known for funding documentaries for public television in the United States. But they have this new initiative this year called Future States, which was to fund a series of short science fiction films, which is exactly right up my alley. I mean, that's kind of what Robot Stories was all about. Robot Stories was an anthology picture. on this. For some reason, I've just been really interested in plants. I've been really thinking a lot about plants, and have been reading a lot about it, and spent some time in a garden, and also, of course, I've been, you know, very, you know, reading up on global warming and stuff like that. This idea kind of came together from some of those disparate elements. I can't really say too much about it without spoiling it, other than to say, so I guess the best way to explain it is just it's a sci-fi story, and it's a story of a jaded government undersecretary for global warming who lives in a world where catastrophic climate change has become reality. Mm. Basically, he blew it. He blew it, and everybody else blew it, and it happened. And so he's kind of at the worst point in his career and personal life and everything else. He gets embroiled in a mysterious plot with a former colleague of his, who has a crazy plan to save the planet. And that's as much as I can say without spoiling it. But it's just 15 minutes long. It's going to be a sci-fi London, and check it out.
Working at Marvel, you obviously enjoy working in that sandbox, as a lot of people describe it, and developing characters. But at the same time, your contribution to Secret Identities, your short film, Mr. Green, allows you to do work that is perhaps a little bit more political. So having these two different opportunities, mainstream comics and then more independent work, I guess it's nice to be able to move from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't ever really thought of, you know, one side being more political than the other. Maybe that's at the same time, you know, both Magneto Testament and War Machine were fairly, you know, heavy duty with either politics or history. But Marvel's been very good about letting me do stuff, you know, certain things on the side, and definitely the film stuff that's an itch that I always want to scratch.
Hopefully we'll see another feature from you at Sci-Fi London one of these days.
I would be very, very happy about that. I'm always working to try to get something underway, so you never know. eventually it'll happen.
Cool.
Okay, cool.
For more info about Greg's work, please visit his website at www.packbuzz.com. That's www.packbuzz.com. And to see his latest short film, Mr. Green, on the big screen, please visit the London Science Fiction Film Festival, Sci-Fi London, between the 30th of April and the 3rd of May. More info at tinyurl.com/SFLshorts. While we're on the subject of Sci-Fi London, there are various comic book events taking place during the festival. Manga creators Kate Brown, Karen Rubens and Emma Viacelli are guests of the Geek Girl Diners on the 29th of April at 7 p.m, which is a free event open to women who may bring men as guests. On Saturday the 1st of May, there's a panel on the 60th anniversary of Dan Dare, which was actually this week, but let's not split hairs, featuring Garys Erskine and Leach, John Freeman and Ryan Hughes. The same day, there's one on Marvel UK, also with John Freeman and Gary Erskine, alongside Des Skin, Dan Abnett and Simon Furman. Then on Monday the 3rd of May, there's one on comics and film, with Howard Webster, the creator of The Many Worlds of Jonas Moore, viral video animator Syriac Harris, of Teddy Bears Invading Worthing Pier fame, and graphic novelist Woodrow Phoenix. More info at www.sci-fi-london.com. Before that, there are various other comic book events taking place. Wham! First Sight Colchester's 3-week Festival of Comics is currently on, and features a residency by artist David Bailey, and a talk about subversive manga by Ilya and Chi Kutuwada on Wednesday the 28th. More info about Wham! Can be found at www.firstsight.uk.net. That's firstsite.uk.net. Graphically speaking, Rutu Modan, Amruta Patil and Jacob Strid are talking about their work at the Royal Festival Hall in the South Bank Centre of London on the 17th of April in a panel discussion chaired by Paul Gravett, in which they're talking about their graphic novels from Israel, India and Denmark. More info at www.internationalpen.org.uk. Then, from April the 22nd to April the 25th, Unicomics at the University of Hertfordshire is taking place, a four-day event featuring film screenings, talks and panels by Pat Mills, Dave Gibbons, Kevin O'Neill, Gary Erskine, Ian Culbard and Sarah McIntyre. More info at www.unicomics.co.uk. That's unicomics.co.uk. For more info about all the above, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.